Okay. Well, this time, before we go, we still have two more talks. This next one is all about F-sharp, and we've been hearing about F-sharp for the last 2 days. F-sharp is the cool thing that everyone's doing, and you know, I'm all excited to see Roger talk about F-sharp. And Roger is, he's got all kinds of fancy things in his bio. VP and co-founder and CTO.
And I had, I had the longest bio, I think, of anybody.
But hopefully there's code in these slides, so I'm sure there is. I'm sure we'll have lots of fun F-sharp to look at. Let's welcome Roger.
Hi. Let me get going here. So there was a really great question yesterday around why are we doing DSLs? What is the motivation? And for me in particular, and for my company, the motivation is shortest time to value. We are, you know, delivering services to customers, and they're looking for, you know, quick delivery. They don't want to spend a lot of money on building systems, and so we have a very practical view of what to use this, you know, these kinds of techniques for. And so what I'll talk about today is kind of that sort of practical view of what, you know, what DSLs are for. So I'm a managing partner for ASIC Systems, a provider of consulting and training services for financial and telecommunications clients. It seems like another one of the discussions yesterday, it seems, you know, we see domains like, you know, financial services and telecommunications in particular have these rules-rich kind of environments. And those end up lending themselves really well to this kind of DSL approach. In addition to that, we're also doing visualizations in what I call visual analytics for our customers, or, you know, what I like to call also game programming for business that we're doing with, you know, fancy new libraries that .NET provides, for instance. So F-sharp language-oriented programming. The term language-oriented programming has been around for a while. And actually, the concepts are, you know, quite old. However, F-sharp ends up bringing together an interesting set of capabilities that make doing language-oriented programming actually very straightforward. Straightforward in a way that makes, from my perspective, makes it easy to actually use in the context of delivering services to my clients. I mean, you know, these aren't research kinds of exercises, you know, and frankly, some of my clients don't really care what the implementation is. They just care what the end result value is, and if I can bring that to them, or if my company can bring that to them in a quick manner, that's all they really care about. So the set of features that F-sharp provides at a high level are type-oriented language specifications for LOP. I'll talk a lot about that in detail. The notion of data structures as a language. We saw a little bit of taste of that in some of the earlier presentations. And then there are a couple of sort of more detailed or fancier kinds of features, quotations and computation expressions. I'm not going to go into them because they could just be a whole talk. And you know, there's a whole bunch of sort of background context that's required in order to really kind of get your head around that stuff. But suffice to say that F-sharp provides a really rich set of capabilities. And that's going to be the focus of my discussion, those two bullet points. So we talk a lot about language, and I like, you know, this kind of language example is always interesting, which is it's kind of the way the notation affects the way people think about ideas. I think several of the ancient texts were sort of written in this manner where you would essentially read the text like you were plowing a field. Classics were written in this manner, and in order to understand what you were reading, you actually had to listen to the sounds that were coming out of your mouth. And so the effect of which is sort of hiding almost hiding the ideas and the mechanics of the language, you know. Of the way the speaking, and that sort of metaphor you know we see a lot in terms of DSLs of how we focus, you know, how we think about notation and you know, for a particular set of purposes, and you know, so this Booster Fedrin was really kind of language 1.0, you know, and as as languages evolved, they ended up, we ended up sort of breaking into syntaxes, and actually there's a whole branch of philosophy that contemplates how when the oral tradition moved to the written tradition, the way it affected the way we can share information, and certainly now programming is sort of the next step of that process. Okay, so what does all that mean? Well, it's this notion of the power of notation. We kind of throw that word notation around all the time. But what does it mean? It means that now with DSLs, you actually can control, abstract certain things about the way your program operates, or the way it, to even think about the program in a way that you couldn't before. The compiler compile code, if you're thinking about an Algolish, C-sharp, Java side of the world, the code for the most part, executes in the order you see it in text, but now when you think about DSLs, you can sort of change all that stuff around, and it gives us a degree of freedom that you didn't have before, and so now we're sort of thinking about, well, what can we do with that? And to Don's point, we're going to figure that out. We're going to figure out, well, what are useful ways of using this, and we're also going to figure out what are terrible ways of applying this sort of new power. This notion of controlling our notation and changing it and mastering it. And, last year I spent a lot of time thinking about or working on Clojure, which is a Lisp running on the JVM. And it's interesting, I think there's a great quote that says, Lisp isn't a language, it's a building material. I think so, something to that effect. In Lisp, you're sort of exposed to the structure of the language more explicitly, and in F Sharp it's more implicit, and you have the tools to change and manipulate the notation in much the same way you have analogous tools in Lisp. But just in Lisp it's a little more explicit, but it's been interesting for me to sort of contrast the two those languages, Lisp or Scheme and F Sharp. So the interesting thing was this notion of the relationship between DSLs and frameworks. Frameworks are great. I mean, they end up, we don't have to write everything from scratch now. We have lots of predefined libraries that we can use, programmers don't think about, pulling in a framework to solve some particular problem. But when we think about DSLs, we can think about things that are really, feels really good to use them on, at least from like my particular experience. And we hear sort of these themes in the other presentations. So this notion of boilerplate heavy code, I mean, we've all sort of found ourselves programming or typing a bunch of boilerplate code, and there are lots of different ways, like, macros pre-processing tricks and inheritance and a bunch of other things that deal with boilerplate. But boilerplate is a constant issue in terms of creating drag for the developer. This notion of repeated patterns of usage, we see if you ever put systems together and you see like a lot of self-similarity, that's sort of an indicator that maybe a problem could be cut effectively with a DSL approach. And then, need implementation portability. That is, you're targeting different kinds of machines or different kinds of, installation types of scenarios where you want to have a representation that you can essentially distribute in different ways. And, common way to think about or a common problem is like, I'm targeting, writing, for example, a visualization and using some particular library. I'd like to take that same visualization and use it with another particular library, depending on the platform that I'm interested in or my client's environment. So those are sort of, to me, like really good potential candidates for DSLification. It's a new word. So we think about languages as logic. What we can do with that logic, and we've thrown this sort of word around combinators, and basically it's a way of essentially building up functions that can combine to make other functions. And that has a, you know, that has a tremendous amount of utility. We have a new language. Here's an example of sort of building up combinators for doing logic. I'll just sort of blow through this because I wanted to sort of get to the, and then we hear new logical reduction. But why combinators in particular? Well, they promote recursive problem solving and reasoning by substitution. And, you know, I was having this discussion with my business partner, in my career, how many problems have I solved recursively? You know, I was like kind of thinking about that. You know, and really I couldn't, I maybe came up with like one maybe, you know, and it was like, and I was thinking, why don't I use, you know, when I was in computer science class, they were like, we're going to teach you this very powerful concept called recursion. But, you know, as a practical matter, I never ended up using it, you know, in like any kind of like business context. I mean, maybe I'm a schlock developer and I just never had occasion to use it. But what's interesting is, in using, you know, this notion of combinators in F-sharp and looking for this like self-similarity and trying to, you know, create these ASTs and DSLs, I find myself now thinking about problems, you know, in that way, and ends up being just another way of thinking about problems. And, I mean, it's nothing special, and it doesn't really seem to take any more mental energy to do that. But it's funny how important like a notation or the use of tools can reorient the way you decompose a problem. And I think this is kind of a subtle thing, but it's really important. And I'll get to specifics. So, you know, here's some combinators that are, you know, familiar. You know, we could argue about the academic definition of combinators, but like pipe and redirect, and we see these, and we've seen these in Unix, and they end up, obviously providing Unix with scary levels of expressiveness. Right, and I pulled this example, which was a hilarious example of a search for ELIS files. Okay, so thinking about language and notation, when we read code, you sort of going to construct the, you know, theory of the program in your head, and you execute it, and you step by step it. And but when, you know, as you start thinking about building languages, you start thinking about sort of decomposing the actual language into, you know, for example, an if statement has statement list and Boolean expression, and then we can sort of wind that together and build up a tree, okay, and then substitute values, okay, and then, you know, we've been talking about abstract syntax trees, and we look at, you know, grammar tree. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, you know, if we start looking at, I mean, for those of you that are familiar with, grammar notation, you know, Lex and Yak and those kinds of tools provide Antler and Oslo. We have different ways of expressing grammars. And what's interesting about F-sharp is we end up having the capability of translating, you know, this syntax tree into a type, what's referred to as a discriminated union. If you notice, the notation is actually very, you know, very similar. And these types end up being very easy to compose together and do things with. You know, so they provide a very, you know, what I would call a lightweight mechanism for actually building DSLs. And so we see this type, and as we step through the evaluation of this type, we see that we have, you know, while and an if, and a while is a tuple expressions and statement list, and so we have a very, like I said, a very direct syntax from the from a BNF form to a discriminated union in F sharp. Okay. Some other interesting stuff. F sharp also has the ability to essentially elevate to the type system the notion of having some or none of a particular type, and that's very helpful because you end up in these situations where a good example is sort of this notion of defensive programming. I don't know if you guys have, you know, like you're programming a particular, you know, API, and then you get some parameters that come in, and you're like, well, hold on, has some, am I going to get past null here? You know, and then you're, you know, oh, I need to check for null, and oh, you know, that, yeah, I know those bastards, they're not going to, you know, I know I'm going to get null, or, you know, and so you end up like with all this code inside your APIs and your methods that deal with kind of bad, well, in particular, null. And F# has a way essentially to elevate this sort of concept to the type system and allow the compiler to actually help check for these kinds of the evaluation of for example, some and none, and the compiler will tell you like whether those cases are covered. I'll just keep moving forward. Okay. Another great thing about discriminated unions is we have the ability to essentially take evaluate and match against a particular pattern, and so here we end up collecting values in a tree, a binary tree, and as we collect values, we end up saying, okay, well, we're going to match on a node of L tree and right tree. And then that match ends up essentially like a function call, and then we end up taking, if we do match on of type node, then we sort of pass it to collect values. It's pretty straightforward. Okay. I have a couple of other tree examples. Here's a really good example of where, red black trees, they, you know, really hard to implement, at least for me. In this particular example, you have the ability to essentially, you know, chain matches down so that you can evaluate and figure out, okay, well, I'm matching this, you know, this pattern's matching, and then I'm going to match this sub pattern. So there's no limit to the amount of chaining of pattern matching that you can do. In this particular case, we see a balance, and it's very concise notation. And this is just a little bit of a little comparison here in terms of pattern matching and then doing dispatch. Actually, pattern matching, the way F# does pattern matching, is actually a little bit faster than, substantially faster than object subtype dispatching, just because of the way the F# pattern matching is implemented. There's an additional step that happens in order to do object dispatch. And so what happens is as a consequence, it ends up being very useful in terms of even, you know, putting the pattern matching in deep inner loops and those kinds of things. And we've been able to do big pattern matching for our clients and not be so concerned about the performance impact. And as a matter of fact, it's something that's a very strong aspect of the language, is the performance aspect.
Than virtual function dispatch or some other kind of subtype tests?
Then virtual function dispatch. That's what I'm... Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about this sort of notion of game programming for business. In this particular case, here's an example of DSL for doing 3D visualization. And so, again, you know, we end up building up this set of types that allows us to essentially compose together the underlying API framework calls so that we can actually render a particular 3D visualization. This actually ends up being the specification. You end up with a fairly fits on maybe a couple of PowerPoint slides. This is the type specification. Okay, so we have lines and surfaces and triangles and so forth and so on. And then we have essentially the eval function, which, you know, takes a particular model and then actually, you know, breaks that model up into its, you know, whatever the subtypes are recursively. You know, we have that metacircular evaluator thing. And then we end up with a set of production rules. Right, so a line type with these particular that's composed of these particular sets of things or these particular things ends up breaking out into, you know, a particular set of function calls. And so that's that self-similarity sort of showing up. It's, you know, I end up actually building up this language. I run it through. I have a set of production rules. When I was, you know, when I was, you know, putting the, you know, one of the DSLs together, I found myself just working on the tiny part, the little fragment production rule, and debugging that and unit testing that. And then once I had that done, then I could just plug it into the DSL, and then I had something that actually worked actually quite nicely, like almost off the bat. Okay. Well, I'm like way ahead of time. So we'll take a look at a little bit code. So we put together DSL for doing some actually some stock charting for the purposes pedagogical purposes for the class. And so again, you know, we have this sort of notion of here's my DSL. Okay, it's pretty straightforward. I have lines, I have charts, I have bar charts, I have candlesticks, I have circles, annotations. And then I'm a big fan of WPF, and so, you know, this probably looks like a, you know, like mishmash of stuff, but basically we end up taking a line and producing essentially a geometry, and then we bind a particular render to a geometry. And so the programming exercise is essentially coming up with the types of things that you're going to want to essentially produce, and then the production rules to produce them. And then this particular example, and I know this is, you know, just, you know, one metric. It's, you know, including some setup functions and whatnot. It's not that much code to sort of think about. Yes, go ahead.
What's the client code here? Because this is the infrastructure, right?
Yes, I'll show you that in a second. And so if I'll bring up the script. And so basically, I have this function here that, for the most part, fits in one, that builds up a, well, actually, let me back it up a little bit here to provide some context. So at the end of the day, I end up essentially constructing from a set of data, a line, a bar chart, a chart, and I have a function that goes someplace and gets a particular, you know, ticker information, and I go ahead and compose up the underlying representation, the underlying produce out the underlying objects that are required in order to visualize that representation. And I end up with really not that much, really at the end of the day, not that much code to think about. And so, for instance, I'll talk a little bit about this. So. So what happens is, so there are a couple of things here. This, I think, is like 5 years of data or something like that. And what you end up doing is you end up thinking about the tiny production rules in order to generate, you know, whatever it is that you're looking to produce, you know, based on an underlying framework. You know, frameworks tend to be verbose in their APIs and the setup. There's just so much setup that's required in order to do anything, you know, substantive, I guess, in most frameworks. I mean, although there are a lot of frameworks that are getting better. And then you end up essentially using those, building up your type system and then creating these production rules and then taking the underlying objects, or in this particular case, WPF objects, and producing out, you know, on the basis of a data stream, you know, an output. You know, this is an example that we walk our students through in about a day. You know, they get a feel for it, and it's to our mind, it's very lightweight, in the sense that You know, you're not, you know, you don't have to build up a, you know, huge, you know, grammar or these are constructs that are built, you know, right into the language. And this is the, these are the things that that are very appealing to us, you know, sort of that lightweight nature. Okay. And so I'll talk a little bit about some of these specifics. One of the great things about F sharp and, you know, essentially thinking about these kinds of constructs is we end up essentially building up these types that compose up functions that end up being evaluated. But, you know, like I said, in general, you know, that sort of composition ends up being very straightforward. You know, it's not a lot of mechanics. You know, I'm evaluating a function, I'm building up a set of objects, and then, you know, then I'm done. I was kind of scared about the, that was great visuals in the previous demo, and I had some visuals, so I was a little worried about the follow-up on that, so just be honest. Another cool thing is think about 3D stuff. Now, 3D is actually really, again, great set of libraries, but lots of programming in order to get, even with the nice stuff that WPF provides, lots of stuff to set up in order to get going. And so I was going to do a couple an example and then talk a little bit about what we did in the wild for our customers. Well, I think I'm resetting my session. So like for example, I'm going to build up a 3D representation here. I know this is like very compelling watching me select code and. And then I'll go ahead and, you know, for instance, evaluate. And let's see where my window is. Nope, I didn't have my printer. Sorry. So in F sharp, the interactive, you can override the notion of the REPL, the print. And in this particular case, or in the previous case, I overrode the printer in order to, I was not reset, apologize. Alt enter, there we go. Then I'll, okay, so now we have the interactive, and then we're gonna add a printer, and then I'll show a scene, and then I'll show you guys a 3D visualization of stock information. Okay, so we have a scene, and let's see, do we have, okay, we have a blank window, and then we're gonna, for example, I'm gonna add a sphere to that window, just to do that. Okay, so we have a sphere. Okay, so, you know, we end up essentially being able to compose up scenes of things and animate them, and, well, what does that mean? Well, here's an example. This is an early prototype. And it's a little grainy, I apologize, of 3D visualization that we did for one of our clients. And so what we're showing here is a real-time visualization of supply-demand curve for a particular stock. And so we were able to process this data real-time and build up a volume of data. This is actually a very early version, and I can show it because the client signed off on, you know, using it as a demo. I can't show any of the latest stuff, unfortunately. And so what we were able to do is essentially compose up this visual analytic on the basis of this of, you know, a DSL, and then allows essentially an end user to see what motion is like around a particular ticker symbol. And you know, there's lots of features. Actually, there's a heads up display that we put together for this, It turned out to be a really interesting problem space because, for the, you know, performance reasons, and then also, really taking advantage of the underlying capabilities that now WPF provides. Whatever. So In terms of wrap up, I'll go back to the slides. On that note, so what, you know, in terms of F sharp, I mean, that was kind of like a drive by breeze through. In terms of F sharp provides a really rich set of metaprogramming capabilities, and they end up actually being very lightweight. You know, they're integrated in the language. You have Visual Studio integration, which is, you know, to my mind, great. And you have Visual Studio 2010 is going to be even better. Combinator libraries, I mean, it just sort of, you start thinking in those terms and you end up being able to cut problems in a different way, and that ends up providing a lot of utility. It's a convenient way to program frameworks. I mean, that's actually what drew me to Clojure on Java, was this notion of actually taking, you know, like a rich set of libraries that already is in existence and animating them in a totally new way, and getting, you know, that order of magnitude productivity increase. And I think, you know, the DSL approach can provide that kind of capability if deployed in the right way. And I think lightweight approaches actually are really, I think should be like investigated, because, you know, you don't have to, you know, bite off on, like, I don't think big DSL implementations in order to get real value. If you think about the capabilities of, most problem spaces, you end up confronted with this, you know, problem of excessive typing and you know, manipulation of programs. And again, as I mentioned, I think those are the areas where DSLs and DSL approaches end up being very, very helpful. Okay. I finished way early, but any questions? Yes.
What makes the mindset, or what makes a piece of code language oriented? Is it the build working towards creating combinators and composing functions? Is that sufficient to be language oriented?
That's a really good question. I think what it comes down to is, I think it's like thinking at that sort of meta level. You know, I'm actually thinking about manipulating the interpretation of the code, or I'm thinking about the language in order to produce some output. You know, I'm sort of up a level from just, you know, sort of taking the, you know, whatever, you know, the compiler or the interpreter does, you know, at face value or whatever it does. I mean, as soon as you're sort of in that realm, I think you're thinking about sort of that meta-linguistic or language-oriented in those. And I think, you know, when you think about different tool sets and tool chains and languages, you know, you can think about what features they provide to think at that level, I guess. I don't know if that answers your question. Other questions? Great. Thanks. Thank you.